Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 23rd of October. Yesterday on this show, during this hour, we spoke with a guest who was in favor of the Barack Obama plan for health care reform in this country. Today, we have another point of view on health care reform from Joseph Antos. He is the Wilson Taylor Scholar in Healthcare and Retirement Policy at the American Enterprise Institute for Public Policy Research, also a commissioner of the Maryland Health Services Cost Review Commission, adjunct professor at the School of Public Health at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. And his research focuses on economics of health policy, including Medicare reform, health insurance regulation, and the uninsured. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Professor Antos during this hour as we continue our discussion of one of the most important issues facing Americans these days, and that is the cost of health care and the number of people who are uninsured in this country. Can we, I guess the question of the hour is, have health care reform in this kind of economy that we are living in? Our phone number for you to join the conversation is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, or feel free to use the email addresses as we have here, which is talk@wpr.org. Professor Joseph Antos, hello. Thanks so much for being with us.
Good morning, Kathleen. I'm delighted to be here.
Yeah, nice to have you with us. Let's start with a question. If health care reform of any kind is possible in the economy that we're living in, or is it just a pipe dream?
Oh, it's certainly not a pipe dream, but of course, it's going to be much more difficult under the current circumstances than we thought before. I mean, no one thought that health reform was going to be easy, but with the tremendous financial problems that the country is now facing, it will be much more difficult.
Mm-hmm. How many people would you say are uninsured right now in this country, and is there a part of the Obama plan or the McCain plan that will cover people who don't have health insurance, which is not a good thing?
Right, it's not a good thing. The Census Bureau says that there are about 46 million people who are uninsured, or at least were uninsured last year. As you probably know, there's a lot of controversy over what that number really means. I think it's a waste of time to try to come up with an exact number. The fact is that it's many millions of people, and it's a serious issue. So both candidates have elements of their plans that would certainly help many people go from uninsured status to having health insurance. But neither candidate has the key to grant everyone good access to health care through some sort of health insurance plan. It's just not feasible. There are lots of holes in the proposals, both McCain and Obama, but both of them have the intention of substantially increasing the number of people who would have health insurance coverage.
Mm-hmm. Neither has the key. Do you have the key?
I think we have to look for a higher power and a lot of hard work. There are lots of things that need to be done to work on the cost side of the equation, to improve the value that our health dollar brings to us. And if we work in those areas, then we can expect to see more people with coverage, and more people with coverage that they can afford and that taxpayers can afford as well.
Mm-hmm. You've talked about Obama's plan as having hopes that are too audacious to be believed. Can you talk more about that? What's too audacious?
Sure. Well, the rhetoric, and of course, let's keep in mind that both candidates are running for office, and so on both sides, the rhetoric is a little extreme. But in Senator Obama's case, he's claiming, for example, that through his plans, that not only will everyone or nearly everyone be covered by health insurance, but that insurance will be as good as your congressman's. Well, your average congressman is probably in an excellent specific health plan. The average federal employee is in a Blue Cross plan that costs about $12,000 a year. It's a great plan, but it doesn't seem plausible. It shouldn't seem plausible that that level of spending for health insurance is going to be possible for absolutely everyone, it doesn't seem plausible that the 46 million people or so who are uninsured are going to end up in a plan like that. And I don't think that the average American really believes this kind of rhetoric, and they shouldn't.
We were talking yesterday with a guest who said, and Obama has said this as well, that such a plan may be feasible if you increased taxes, income taxes, on people who make $250,000 a year or more. Is that a possibility or not?
Well, that's a start, but I think the kind of money that Senator Obama's plan implies clearly indicates that you're going to run out of people who make more than $250,000 a year. You're going to have to dip down into the middle class. There will be middle class tax increases under his plan because you can't do it any other way. Now, there's a reason for that. He lays out a vision rather than a plan for reducing the cost of health care. And the vision is a great vision, but we're not going to get there certainly in his term of office over the next 4 years, or even if he's a two-term president, for the simple reason that the elements of his cost containment are things that we, in fact, have been talking about for the last 20 or 30 years. So you know, we've been talking about them. We've been working toward them. We're not close to getting there yet. Well, let me take a breath here,
sure.
But I'd like to mention a few of his ideas.
Sure.
They're fine ideas, but we're not ready.
Mm-hmm. And you talk about improving healthcare efficiency, that he talks about that. He talks about electronic health records and e-prescribing that are popular ideas with politicians on both sides of the aisle. Are those the things that you're talking about that he would do that we're already engaged in doing?
Well, we're engaged in talking about them, but yes, those are the sorts of ideas that he has. They're great ideas. Senator McCain also supports many of the same ideas. The problem, of course, is that when you have opposing politicians agreeing on something, there's got to be something wrong. And in this case, the something wrong is that that set of proposals are neither panaceas to the problems that we have about cost. And furthermore, as I say, the reason that we haven't implemented them is because there are both technical problems, financial problems, and political problems associated with actually getting these things to go.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, health information technology, a very, very important idea, something that we have indeed been talking about for more than 20 years now. The health sector is one of the few industries that is a knowledge-based industry, but it does not use its own information very well. I think everybody realizes that when you go to the doctor and you have to fill out that form that asks for your medical history and your prescriptions, and you have to fill out that form every time you go to a new doctor, you know that's part of the system that could easily be fixed if we simply applied computer technology to what is really a very simple set of questions. But we don't do it, and mm-hmm. there are lots of reasons why we haven't so far. If the ideal health information technology system were installed, that's the easy part. The hard part, and where you get the savings, is the change in medical practice that Senator Obama and a lot of people assume will automatically happen. But in fact, that is the hard work. As hard as it is to solve the political and financial and technical difficulties of getting good computer technology into the hands of physicians and hospitals and getting that technology to communicate with each other, the much more difficult problem is that in order to save the money, the practice of medicine has to change.
In what ways?
Well, clearly, we have a situation that is fostered not only by the fact that we don't easily communicate important information about patients from one healthcare provider to the other, but we also have the problem that all of the economic incentives drive the provision of health care in fairly wasteful ways. You know, one of the images that people often have is that, well, if we had good electronic health records, then we wouldn't have to repeat diagnostic tests. Well, that might be true, but if we pay for every diagnostic test that's done, then electronic health records won't slow down the flood of diagnostic testing. It's not just access to information. It's also the financial incentives. And then furthermore, there are other issues. Physicians are often right. I'm going to stay with this example. Physicians are often correct that you need to do the test again. Time has elapsed from the last test, and you need to know what is the condition of the patient right now, not 2 weeks ago. Sometimes that's warranted, sometimes that's not. But that's a judgment call. Frankly, we don't have a good scientific basis for making that judgment call.
Mm-hmm. What about the insurance industry? You've written about that, Professor Antos, the administrative costs of private insurance. Is there a lot of money that could be saved there? Does that system need to be changed? Is it a money-grubbing industry?
Profit is not a bad word in this country, even in the health sector. Money grubbing, I don't think I'd want to use that particular term. Of course, it's true that health insurers could do their jobs more efficiently. That's true for every industry, for every company. They could do a better job, there's no doubt about it. This year, according to the government actuaries, we will spend something like $100 billion in administrative costs for insurance. Now, that seems like a lot of money,
mm-hmm.
but remember that that's compared to about $2.2 trillion that we are spending in total for health care, including administration. So that's really about 10 or 12% of the total healthcare costs. That's not where, you know, the real money is not in administration, although we could do a better job there. The real money is in the delivery of healthcare.
Mm-hmm. Let's welcome phone calls. Our guest this hour is Professor Joseph Antos, Wilson Taylor Scholar in Healthcare and Retirement Policy at the American Enterprise Institute for Public Policy Research. He's also a professor, adjunct professor at the School of Public Health at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Yesterday, we had a guest extolling the virtues of Senator Barack Obama's health care reform plan. Today, Professor Antos has some deep concerns about that plan, and we're talking about those and continuing our conversation of reforming the American healthcare system. Is it possible? What would make the most difference? Is anything possible during this time when the economy is not very good? 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655 is the number, or send an email if you'd like, and that is talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Just a reminder, a week from today, we'll be taking our broadcast to Marquette University, a special two-hour live broadcast, and it will only be days before the presidential election. Mike Ushe will be joining me, distinguished fellow in law and public policy and host of Marquette Law School's Forum on the Issues. He's been a long time at WTMJ and is now at WISN Television doing a special show on Sunday and public affairs program and also doing election coverage. We will have people from the McCain campaign, from the Obama campaign. Many students will join us. We'll have people covering national politics and the campaigns for newspapers, and it should be just a really good time, plus chocolate cake and coffee at the end. So come and join us. It'll be fun to see you in person, and we'll just talk about all of these issues, healthcare and the economy and the war and who you think would be best to lead the country for the next 4 years. It should be a great time. We're just asking that you let us know. It's free, but let us know that you're coming so we have a seat reserved for you. And here's the number for you to call, 414-227-2047. 414-227-2047. Again, that's a live broadcast at Marquette. It's a week from today. It's all coming up pretty soon. Healthcare reform again this hour with Professor Joseph Antos. 800-486-8655 is our number. And let's start our calls with Dave from Waterford. Hi, Dave.
Hi, good morning.
Hello.
Hi there. You know, I just had a question. It was just regarding, like, healthcare events that are very catastrophic. You know, I can speak personally. I had heart surgery that cost about $100,000 5 years ago, and I look at like I'm thinking like, does the program for Obama deal with those less occurring events that are very costly? And because I wonder if, and also I was going to ask the professor if out of the whole like healthcare expenditure that we do in our country, how much of a percentage are these so-called like heavy-hitting events that happen to
mm-hmm.
people?
And did you have insurance at that time, Dave?
Yeah, I did. And the irony is, I'm so fortunate to have insurance, and I would like to have people covered for those kinds of things. But you know, one of the ironies is while I was in the hospital, there was an accident which caused me to have another surgery, but the hospital wouldn't. It's kind of interesting. This is a separate issue, but the hospital wouldn't claim responsibility for it. So I had to pay for that procedure
Ooh.
With my insurance, but I had to pay my copay for that. So
mm-hmm.
it's kind of ironic, you know. they can treat you. They can do really good things to help people, but when they hurt you in the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
You're on your own. Separate
mm-hmm.
issue, but
right.
But I was hoping
okay.
if the professor could talk
sure.
about that.
Sure.
Thank you.
And if you would please, Professor Antos, cover both the McCain and the Obama plans when it comes to catastrophic health care, because it can wipe out a family completely. If he hadn't had insurance, the bills for years.
Absolutely. Actually, all three points that Dave brings up are extremely important. Both candidates recognize the real point of insurance, which is to cover those, as Dave said, those rare, completely unaffordable, unexpected expenses. That's really what this is all about. There are plenty of differences between Obama and McCain, but this is not one of them. They completely understand and agree with Dave, and I think with all of us who've thought about it, that people need to have that kind of protection, not just financial protection, but also the assurance that if something goes wrong, that they will actually seek treatment and they'll get it. So that's incredibly important. Both of them handle this. The way they handle it is sometimes a little bit different. For example, in the McCain case, he says that if you have a pre-existing condition that disqualifies you from insurance, that he would create something called a gap plan, an assistance program run through the states that are similar to what are called technically high-risk pools. The basic idea is that if you can't buy insurance because of some pre-existing condition, that this would be the insurer of last resort, and that's not a bad term. It means that you would get coverage. At least that's his vision. With Senator Obama, he takes a more conventional view. He basically says we're going to require that all insurance meet certain standards, and the standards that he would set are basically, as he says, what your congressman gets. And your congressman absolutely has that kind of high-end financial protection.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what's the percentage of total health care costs that end up in this category of totally unexpected, extremely high cost? And I think the answer, surprisingly, is not as high as you might think. In fact, while this is obviously a serious consideration for somebody going through this, if it's a single episode of care, then that doesn't necessarily imply high costs forever. So, in fact, the really big spenders in this country in terms of health care are the people with multiple chronic conditions who may have from time to time an acute
episode that requires very, very expensive intervention, but whose overall spending is high even in the absence of an acute episode.
What about, we were talking about this some yesterday, and I'm wondering if your figures jive with yesterday's guest. What percentage of healthcare dollars would you say are spent in the last year of life?
This is really problematic. We don't really know the answer to this question. The only source of information that even comes close to giving us an answer is looking at the Medicare population, because we know how much we're spending in Medicare, whereas we don't have good information about what is spent by private insurers or what is really spent by individuals on their own under the age of 65. So what we do know is that looking at Medicare expenditures, that something like 30% of the average person's total Medicare expenditures over the time that they're in the program from age 65 until their death, about 30% of that is incurred in the last year or two of life. It's not the 90% that some people seem to think. Now, if it's 30% of Medicare, that means that probably on average it's substantially lower than that if you also account for the healthcare spending that would have occurred before the age of 65, maybe 20-25%. It's important, but if we solve that problem, we have not solved the health spending crisis.
Thanks, Steve, so much for your call. Jeff from Madison is next. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, good morning. You asked a little while ago the disparity between what it costs for overall medical care administration and overhead in our system. And your guest kind of skirted the issue and gave a figure of 12% as some sort of a guide mark. That's pretty bad news for people trying to find out what's real, because the last figures I saw were that the overall bill in America was $1.3 trillion for medical care dollars. And the percentage that was laid on this is somewhere between 25% and 30%. Now, we have the better example of the Canadian system, which spends a mere 1% on each overhead and administrative costs. And we also have our own good system, socialized medicine, called Medicare, Medicaid, and I'm old enough to be a beneficiary. You're never going to solve the problem using the corporations who hire doctors and give them bonuses on how much treatment they withhold. And that is what the HMOs have done traditionally. And until we get the health insurance industry and spokespersons from the American Enterprise Institute, which was basically responsible, along with a lot of other right-wing phalanxes, for the privatization and the deregulation and the union smashing, we have seen, and until we expand Medicare, Medicaid for everyone, we'll still be stuck with these bloodsuckers and this misinformation that their spokespersons brings to the public.
Professor Antos.
Well, it's great to know why I work for such a powerful organization. Thanks, Jeff. I appreciate that. Let's talk a little bit about the numbers and then talk about what I think your real issue is, which is shouldn't we go to a completely government-run health system? And a number of people really are convinced about that. But first on your numbers, I don't want the listeners to be confused. You're talking about if you mentioned $1 point something trillion of health spending. That might have been 10 or 15 years ago, but unfortunately we're long past that. So we really are spending about $2.2 trillion this year on health care. Now, to your real question, which is, shouldn't we have a government-run system? Wouldn't that be better? Wouldn't we be able to reduce administrative costs and somehow solve a lot of problems? And many people also think that that would be the way to quality health care as well. The issue there really is, do we want to see a continuation of medical innovation in this country. The fact is that if you put the government in charge, then you get one answer to whatever question is in front of you. Inevitably, they have to make a decision. But in fact, not everybody will agree with that decision. Not everybody will have exactly the same needs. Not everybody will be in exactly the same position. And in fact, I think this is the reason why you see that both candidates, McCain and Obama, are not proposing to go to a totally government-run system. Senator Obama says, if you're happy with what you have in terms of employer-sponsored coverage, you can stay with it. Now, we can argue about whether ultimately his plan leads you there, but nonetheless, as a principle, he's basically saying that we don't want a government takeover of the health system because you lose too much in terms of innovation, you lose too much in terms of the pressure that competition can bring to promote higher value and reduce unnecessary spending.
And what are your thoughts on the employer-based system? Should we mess around with that, or is that should we continue with that? Has it served us well, Professor?
Well, you know, it's an artifact of tax policy that goes back to 1943. And for much of the last 60 years, the employer-sponsored system has served the country extremely well. The issue is that we've sort of turned on a switch, and we don't have any way to back off of where we are now. So what I would argue is that both McCain and Obama are fundamentally correct. Neither one of them wants to blow up the employer-sponsored system, contrary to what some of the campaign ads might say. Neither one of them want to do that. But the fact is that the employer-sponsored system is under a great deal of strain because of the high cost of health care, which, in fact, that system is really underwriting. So we've got to get off the treadmill of complaining about high cost, but then validating the unnecessary spending and the high prices. We've got to get off that treadmill. Obama basically doesn't say get off that treadmill. He would just say let's add more money. McCain's strategy is more fundamentally to get at those fundamental cost drivers. But even with his plan, we should not expect to see a wholesale defection from the employer-sponsored system to something else.
Thanks, Jeff, for your call. Let's go next to Russ from Prairie du Chien. Hi, Russ.
Hi. This is going to sound somewhat similar to what the previous caller had said, but you know, I really strongly disagreed with something the professor said earlier this morning, which spurred my call, and that was that profit is not a bad word in any industry, and that really is the foundation of those people out there like myself who would be in favor of at least a partial health care reform that would involve government participation for essential necessary needs. The real point that I'm trying to make here, and that I think everybody who is in this boat really wants to get across, is that, you know, I really just dislike the thought that everyone involved with the healthcare industry must make a profit in order to actually stay in business and available to offer the services that they offer, and that really is what bothers me about the system today. You know, insurance rates simply have to go up because they have to make money to stay in business, and that's what I think a lot of people are hoping. If the government were to step in and offer some kind of sponsored system where they just merely needed to stay afloat and break even at zero, that would assist, easing those concerns, and at least then people would know that, hey, the reason it costs so much is just because it costs so much, not because, you know, some company is making a substantial profit.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Russ, for your call. Professor Antos.
Yeah, Russ's view is held by many people who want to say that it's the insurance company's fault, but forget that the insurance companies largely pass the money to your physician, your hospital, your health care provider. And so did the insurance companies create the problem, or, you know, is it more fundamental? And clearly it's more fundamental. Russ and other folks would completely agree, I'm sure, that they want to see their family physician to make a decent income. By the way, that's the individual's component of profit. You can call it income, but it's profit. It's the same thing. They don't want to see their local hospital go out of business, and their local hospital will go out of business if they can't do more than break even. That's true for the insurance companies. That's the way the U.S. market system works, not just in healthcare, but everywhere. So there's no getting away from it. Now, having said that, the federal government is deeply involved in many, many ways with the provision of health care. So, I mean, that's another common misconception. I mean, you know, there's a sort of an old health policy joke about the elderly person who goes up to the senator and says, whatever you do, don't let the government mess with my Medicare.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the fact is that the government is in there. The government is paying more, about 50% of the cost of health care today. So the argument that we have a system that is somehow completely dominated by private interests is really quite false.
Can you take on, though, people, I think, get this impression partially because of those who are uninsured, which we've already talked about, but can you have a system much as it is right now where local hospitals, where insurance companies can do more than break even, get their fair share here, and yet still include everybody? The other issue we talked about extensively yesterday was those people who have those multiple chronic conditions, those people who are not able to get insurance because they're sick, which, you know, is an oxymoron. You're sick, so you can't get insurance. It doesn't make a lot of sense. Do either of the plans from McCain or Obama address this pre-existing condition concern? And how big a concern? I hear from people all the time how much a concern it is. How big a concern is it to you, Professor Antos, in a reform of health care?
Well, it's a big issue, but let me just mention the thing that seems silly to you. What's really silly is, when they were healthy, why didn't they get insurance? So that ultimately is the question. There are obviously there are some people who are born with a serious medical problem, so you know, that's not a comment towards them. But for a lot of people in their 20s, they'll say, "Well, gee, I'm healthy, and why do I want to spend money on health insurance? It's not a good deal for me." And then if something bad happens, then they'll say, "Well, why can't I get insurance?" The fact is that you've got to participate in the system. Both candidates recognize this. Obama has his solution. McCain has his solution. But ultimately, if you don't buy insurance and you wait for your house to burn down, your insurance agent is going to say, that's too bad. And that's really a reality we need for people to participate in the system. Now, how do they deal with this sort of problem of pre-existing conditions? As I mentioned, with McCain, he would set up these guaranteed access plans, so-called gap plans, and at least according to the campaign rhetoric, we have yet to see any real details on this, but according to them, if you are rejected for health insurance, then you're eligible to get heavily subsidized insurance through a gap plan. Again, administered through some state agency, but inevitably involving those private insurance companies who actually have the expertise to run health insurance. With Senator Obama, his approach is to say that all insurers must accept everyone, regardless of their health condition. Now, there's going to be a transition period where that's going to be quite problematic unless there are very, very large government subsidies to make all this work. I think that's true for Obama and McCain as well. But if you basically tell insurers you have to take anybody no matter when they show up, no matter what their condition is, and you can't charge anybody a higher premium, even if they are guaranteed to be very, very expensive patients, then you're really setting up the system to fail, because you're saying that the premiums will have to be so high to begin with that those people who procrastinated and suddenly got into trouble can be accommodated, and the only way to do that is to and is to charge young people and healthier people very, very high premiums that will discourage them from buying insurance. They will look for ways to get around the rule. Clearly, this is a self-defeating plan.
More phone calls for Professor Joseph Antos in just a moment. We're talking about healthcare reform, again, a different point of view than the one we had yesterday, and welcoming your phone calls at 800-486-8655. He is Wilson Taylor Scholar in Healthcare and Retirement Policy at the American Enterprise Institute for Public Policy Research. He is also an adjunct professor at the School of Public Health at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, where research focuses on economics of health policy, including Medicare reform, health insurance regulation, and the uninsured. One line is open for you. Thanks very much, Russ, for your call, and we'll take more in a moment. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Back to phone calls now, and let's go to Bruce from Madison. Hi, Bruce.
Hi. Actually, I just want to make one comment first before I ask my question about what you were just talking about, which has to do with people having a serious medical condition and then not being able to get insurance. And I think the professor implied that that usually happens because people procrastinated, they were healthy and then got the condition and then couldn't find insurance. But isn't it often a case where the person would have had insurance at the time through an employer when they developed the condition, lost their insurance for one reason or another, and then, you know, is then in a position of trying to find insurance again and have that difficulty? So that's one question. The other question, though, that I wanted to ask, getting back to administrative costs, you had, again, quoted, 10 to 12%. But I'm also wondering, looking at it from the other direction, if we look at what are the total percentage of our healthcare spending that really goes toward providing services to patients, what percentage that is. And I'm wondering particularly about the costs that go to marketing and advertising. We see so much advertising and marketing from both the insurance companies as well as healthcare providers. And I know, agents that sell insurance obviously are getting commissions and so on. And I'm wondering what percentage of our healthcare spending goes to those categories.
Thanks very much, Bruce, for your call. Professor Antos.
Yeah, thank you, Bruce. The your point about other pathways to not having health insurance, you're absolutely right, of course. Many people who run into this problem with pre-existing conditions run into it precisely from what you said. They came down with something. They really couldn't hold a job, for example, because of the health condition. And when they left their jobs, their insurance didn't come with them. This is a very serious problem. What McCain proposes to do is to encourage people in the insurance industry to offer the kind of coverage that you, the individual, own as opposed to your employer. The Obama solution leaves it in the hands of the employer, but sets up some rules to make it difficult for the for an insurer to say no. They both have ways of attempting to address the problem. I don't think that they necessarily solve the problem, but you're absolutely right. Now, on administrative costs, that includes everything in administration, and I don't know what the breakdown is between marketing, bill processing, which of course that's a big thing for insurers. They're going to pay our bills, so we want them to make sure that what they're paying is actually a legitimate bill. For example, and there's some cost involved there, and we would also like them to take prudent actions that encourage the average patient to do the right thing. So, for example, if it weren't for the actions of insurance companies, instead of using generic drugs, which are essentially the equivalent drug as a brand name, but much cheaper, instead of getting up to about the 60% level usage of generic drugs, which is where the U.S. is right now, we could be where most other countries are, down at 20 or 30%. So this, you know, insurance companies do things that we want them to do. There is marketing involved. I mean, clearly there's less marketing when it comes to going to employer groups, although the secret there is that the employer is doing the marketing. And the employer is doing a lot of the administrative work, so the costs are very hard to reduce in that sense. But nonetheless, they could be reduced. Now, if we went to a single system, which neither candidate wants, a single payer system with only the government plan, there would still be marketing costs, and the reason is that you'd still have to have somebody. In this case, it would be the government. Reaching out to people who didn't, rush to buy insurance, to give them the information and to cajole them or threaten them into buying insurance. So I'm afraid that marketing is a fact of life in this country. Sure, it could be reduced. We could find some efficiencies there, but I think if we're talking about administrative costs, we should also be looking for greater efficiencies in bill processing, greater efficiencies in insurance companies doing a better job of managing the payments and to some extent managing the care, or at least providing information that doctors can use to make better decisions.
Is the marketing more extensive, and is this a problem for prescription drugs? It is amazing. If you watch the news, that's all you see is this, you know, everybody must be sick who's watching the news, because those are all the commercials. Do we need to look at that industry as well, Professor Antos? Would that bring down healthcare costs for the average American?
Not substantially, but sure. I mean, this is a big controversial area. Now, you may wonder, why is it that we see ads for prescription drugs and we don't see ads for, or at least many ads for physicians? For example, you do see ads for hospitals, I think, pretty regularly, but you don't see ads for physicians. And I think one of the reasons is it's the difference in the kinds of products and services that they sell. Prescription drugs are pills. They are clear what they are. They're not services. They are products. And so, to some extent, it's easier to market them through mass media for the reason that one pill of Lipitor is the same as another pill of Lipitor. When you get down to the physician level, there are some long-standing puritanical beliefs about whether physicians should advertise. But in fact, if you look in your local newspaper, you will see ads for things like laser eye surgery or cosmetic surgery. And those are physicians. So we see advertising where it makes sense for that part of the industry, and we don't see advertising where either there's a resistance to it or where essentially you can't differentiate the product. And that's basically true for example, primary care physicians. They would have a hard time claiming that they are substantially different from anybody else, even though they, in fact, really are, but it would be so subtle that it would be hard to advertise. Now, if you could wipe out advertising expenses altogether at all levels, including for hospitals, how much would you save? Well, since total administrative cost in this country is 12%, it's hard to imagine that you could save a huge amount of money, even if it's half. Which it is, it couldn't possibly be, but even if it's half, we're only talking about $50 billion out of a $2.2 trillion health bill.
Let's go to Roger from Beaver Dam next. Hi, Roger.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi. I was just wondering if what the candidates have for caps on lawsuits. I mean, I've worked in healthcare for over 20 years. I've seen doctors do hundreds to thousands of dollars. More afraid of litigation than what they are, you know, that they're sure about their diagnosis, but they have to prove their diagnosis beyond a reasonable doubt. So they do hundreds of extra tests and radiology and so on and so forth. And also, do either one of them address dental insurance for anyone? Because I've seen tons and tons of people with no dental insurance and all, and no access to it at all.
Professor Antos.
Two very different questions. First, on medical tort reform. Senator McCain has been stronger on this issue. He has certainly talked about caps on awards, especially non-economic awards. But beyond that, Senator McCain has talked about other ideas that get more fundamentally at a big, big problem with medical malpractice, and that is that our current system largely excludes a lot of patients who really, really have a claim, but they don't make good cases for the lawyers. And so they tend to get shunted off. If you're not a big enough case, or if you couldn't become the sort of the poster child for a class action suit, a lot of trial lawyers aren't going to be very interested in your case, even if it's completely justified. And so you lose. You don't get your day in court. You don't get compensation for something that happened that shouldn't have happened. So other ideas that have been proposed include developing specialized health courts, for example, that are really administrative procedures where you don't have to spend a lot of money to get a hearing, and if you don't like the result, then you can hire a lawyer and go through the regular legal system. So this is an idea that is of great concern, and it's not just from the standpoint of this defense of medicine that Roger mentioned, but it's also from the standpoint of justice for patients. By the way, good news on this. Increasingly, hospitals and doctors have recognized that in many, many cases, what a patient wants to hear is, "I'm sorry." They don't want money. They recognize that people are fallible. They know that things happen. But, you know, the standard legal advice has been, don't say "I'm sorry," because that's an admission of guilt. And if it's an admission of guilt, then when we end up in court, you're going to lose big time. And I think that attitude is beginning to change, and that's a positive change. Hmm. Now, on dental insurance, you know, in fact, Roger has put his finger on a very important point. We talk about the uninsured, but we're only talking about uninsured for medical treatment. We don't talk about being uninsured for dental services, and nobody wants to talk about long-term care.
Right. And they're both big issues in
this
country.
They're both big issues.
Yeah. Thanks, Roger, very much for your call. Let us go next to Doug from Albany. Hi, Doug.
Hello.
Hi.
My question, first-time caller, long-time listener. My question is specifically, I guess, to Major Medical. Would it be possible under either candidate's plan to remove the employer's responsibility under Major Medical and put that on a group that includes all residents of the state, therefore allowing anyone who loses their job to keep their insurance because they haven't moved, also alleviating some of the responsibility of the employer to pay for all the medical insurance for all and residents of the state? And I'll take my answer off.
Okay. Thanks, Doug.
Okay. You know, it's an interesting idea. This is something that is well beyond what any candidate has talked about. I think what Doug is really talking about is creating an insurance pool. An insurance pool is just a group of people who have all bought insurance. And I think what he's talking about is trying to find a more sensible insurance pool so that we don't run into these problems so much. One potential solution is the McCain idea of guaranteed access plans, which bring people together in a pool with very substantial government subsidies, because these are people who typically already have a serious health condition and oftentimes don't have the money. But what Doug is saying is, couldn't there be some other kind of pool for the average person as well? And clearly he's right. One would have to think about whether you really wanted it at the state level, but there have been ideas floating around for a number of years about creating other kinds of pools through churches, through municipalities, through professional associations, and so on. A problem with trying to do this at a state level, for a big state like California, at a state level, that's California is as big as many, many countries, and it would be really hard to manage something like that. So maybe finding a pool that isn't just employment-based, that is a bit more manageable, would make sense.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much, Professor Antos, for being with us this hour. Our guest, Professor Joseph Antos, Wilson Taylor Scholar in Healthcare and Retirement Policy at the American Enterprise Institute for Public Policy Research. He is also a commissioner of the Maryland Health Services Cost Review Commission, adjunct professor at the School of Public Health at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour and to John Treader for answering our many calls. And thanks, everybody, for your many calls. Just a reminder, a week from today, Thursday, October 30th, from 9 to 11, we broadcast from the Marquette University Alumni Memorial Union Monaghan Ballroom. And it's going to include a reception after the broadcast. We'll have people from the political campaigns with us. Students will join us, and we're going to talk politics just a few days before the election. Admission free. Registration, please, though, to let us know you're coming at 414-227-2047. News is coming up, and we'll return on the Ideas Network.